Gentlemen, we're experimenting today in our experimental course. I've already explained this to our guest, who is Reverend Herbert Charlemagne from Hoffman, Illinois, the brother of our esteemed Dr. Charlemagne, a colleague here on this campus. Pastor Charlemagne's background is Wisconsin Synod, and then he came to Missouri Synod. He graduated from Thienesville, and after that came to Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, in 54, and returned to Watertown and taught Latin and English in Watertown. Then he had congregations in Minnesota, and for the last 10 years, he has had a parish in Hoffman, Illinois, which qualifies him to speak to us concerning the rural ministry today and its future, its uniqueness, and his own assessment of it. So open it up to him, and then after that, ask you to ask him questions. We're distributing copies of last Sunday's church bulletin, some literature he brought along. I've been talking with him for the last half hour in my office, and there are a lot of things that he can share with us which are not in his introductory remarks, so please jot down questions you might have as he proceeds. And so the rest of the program, Pastor Charlemagne, is yours, and
give it to you.
Okay.
Thank you for the invitation. I don't really know how to interpret the coffee. Is this to keep you awake? I'm assuming it is. I appreciate your invitation to speak about the rural parish ministry. I've been in the rural parish ministry for some 13 years. I don't really know what I can say to senior students at the seminary, as you don't already know. But we shall see, since some of you probably will be assigned to the rural parish ministry and work accordingly. Maybe you thought that I would come dragging along a bale of hay, as Linus does his blanket, because each of us has his personal kind of hang-up. But I've entitled this brief presentation, A Parish Priest in Ruralis. You will recognize that this is Luntzmann's Latin, and your finely tuned Latin ear will make the proper correction and say that should be rura and not ruralis as the proper term. A few days ago, I received the latest issue of the AAL correspondence, which you will dutifully receive after a while. And I read all about a fellow parish priest, David Eberhardt, and his ministry at Riverside Church of Detroit. There seems to be real action in that parish, and I know that all of you hope that you will be assigned to go where that kind of action is in the parish ministry. One thinks, therefore, the ministry of inner city or suburbia as a place where action really takes place. And I'm sure that there is plenty of action in those places, but there's also the excitement and the action of the ministry in a rural parish, too. I was told that the topic of this presentation was to be the uniqueness of the rural parish ministry. Perhaps then I should preface it by saying, first of all, the rural ministry is unique, not because of the place, but because of the person of our Lord. And secondly, I should say that the rural ministry is unique not because some parish priest happens to be working among some rural people, but because through word and sacrament, God is working in his world also in rural places. In passing, I might also say this, that in this season of the church year, remember that after all, our Lord was born in a rural place. That always gives me some kind of comfort. I don't know what it is, but so the ministry is unique. I'm not so sure, however, that there's really anything unique in the ministry among rural people. But what I shall say, I'd like to offer from the observation of some dozen years in the rural parish ministry. And I want to emphasize that this is a reflection of parish life in only one parish in Illinois. I do not presume to know the opportunities and challenges of other rural ministries. There is plenty of activity of the Spirit of our Lord, and thus plenty of action among rural people. Fortunately, the activity of the Spirit of our Lord is not limited to megapolis or even to seminaries, but that same Spirit is active in the life of rural places, in the person of Grandma Himmelhoek and Uncle Sauerbraten, too. And you might be surprised how many of the Sauerbratens you will run into. The basic task of the parish priest, whether and wherever he is stationed, is to equip the saints of God in that community of the redeemed to which he has been assigned. That means, first of all, he has to start where the people are, in their appreciation of God's mercy and grace. And in order to do this, he has to know the degree of spiritual growth of his people, and that takes time, takes effort, and understanding. He has to know, too, how to use the God-given equipment for the task. He has to make use of the opportunities in the worship life of his community. In our rural parish, we take seriously the worship life of the community of the redeemed. That means not only taking seriously Articles 1 through 10 of Augustana, but also 11 through 28. It is rather interesting that we seldom get much static from anyone from Article 1 through 10, but we get a great deal of static when we take seriously Article 11. You know this is on confession. Or Article 16 on civil government, or Article 20 on faith and good works, or certainly Article 24 on the Mass. We can probably at this point skip Article 23, the marriage of the priest, at this time because of some ecumenical hang-ups. For instance, we take seriously Article 10 on confession, but sometimes one has to use a bit of understanding to communicate the term effectively. The parish at Huffman, where I'm stationed, is in Clinton County. Clinton County is predominantly Roman Catholic, at least on the west side. And that makes good sense, I guess. West side should be Roman Catholic. The east side. In fact, I talk to my priest friends who are at Modern Day High School, and I tell them that I'm on east side of the county, because the east side is usually more Orthodox. The east end of the county is made up primarily of us who are evangelical Catholics and some protesting Baptists, primitive, hardshell, Southern, American, and what other term they have. So when we therefore practice Article 11, we list it as pastoral counseling. Sometimes the term itself is quite important. 11 years ago when I came to Huffman, I dutifully announced on Sunday that, quote, private confession will be on Friday afternoon and evening, since we're celebrating the Eucharist next Sunday. And this is a bulletin announcement. Of course, nobody showed up on Friday afternoon. Nobody showed up on Friday evening. Nobody was going to be known as a confessor. I learned through a bit of unrefined questioning, sometimes called a third degree, that our Lutheran Church doesn't have private confession. The Catholics do, but they live in the other part of the county. That was a hang-up. It was a matter of terminology. And so we set aside Friday afternoon and Friday evening for pastoral counseling. The change in terminology worked. Now people come for confession. They know it as pastoral counseling. I know it as private confession. The practice is the same. The word only differs. And so there are many opportunities to strengthen the faith of God's people by a full practice of the worship life of the community. For instance, in the emphases of baptism, you will notice in the bulletin that you have there that I publish in the bulletin the anniversary, baptismal anniversary of the people during that particular week. I do this for a reason, to call attention to these individuals that this is the time of their baptism and a reminder of the fact that they are incorporated into the body of Christ. And by use of certain symbolisms, and this is one of them, they are made more aware of the importance of baptism in their own lives. I use a form of baptism which about 6-7 years ago the worship committee suggested to us, in which there is congregational participation. I have this printed on the back side of the bulletin, or in the last cover. We use a candle and the baptismal towel or cloth, whatever term you want to use. The form is printed in the hymnal, and we use these forms as a reminder of the participation of the congregation in this sacred rite, in this baptismal confession. We emphasize also the importance of the chief service of the church by celebrating every Sunday and every holy day the Eucharist as our confession state. For if, and this is a quotation, if the worship of God is the chief purpose of man, and you recognize this from the Scottish Catechism, then each worshiper must pray, sing, and offer himself wholeheartedly in genuine devotion to his risen Lord. For we begin with the premise that a worshiper cannot be a passive spectator, simply witnessing something being done for him, but rather he is an active participant, trained for his activity. One who joins with the angels, the archangels, and the whole company of heaven to magnify the name of the Lord. To aid this worship life of the community, we use, and I'm now quoting a number of things which I originally wrote for Advance Magazine. I don't know if you've ever mentioned it. I have an article in the Advance Magazine of March 66, which immediately precedes yours. I never realized that before.
On Easter Eve.
Yeah, you have this. This is the pastor's role in training congregation in worship. And I have some things in there which I have jotted down also here again. To aid the worship life of the community, we use the Hymn of the Week plan. You're familiar with this. We read together the intro, the collect, the gradual, as congregational responses. We point out the propers for the day in the bulletin, as you notice on the left-hand side there, but also as it fits into the service, explain the lesson, explain the epistle, and explain the gospel, and read it from the proper side of the altar. There are a number of other things that are listed in this article, which I might mention. In private celebrations of the service at home or in hospital, I use the responsive reading forms where the person is able to respond, that is, in the sense of being able to read the form. In the churches during the various seasons of the year, we use the Advent wreath, Paschal candles, the chrismon trees, the full vestments. I use the full Eucharistic vestments with the symbolism that is on the vestments, which can be placed in there, and in my case are. I have a series in here in this particular article, too, on what we do in our school. For instance, we have the worship centers in each one of our rooms in the school. We make use of these worship centers in calling attention to the youngsters of the propers of the week and how this fits into the life of the church and how it fits into the life of the individual. We have our weekly matin service with the youngsters to which the congregation is invited on Wednesday morning or on a festival day, whatever it comes. And we have participation here by members of the parish and the congregation. We use in the 7th and 8th grade, in which I have my confirmation classes, I use a number of materials that point to the form of liturgies and the appreciation that these youngsters may have. For instance, Dr. Brown's book on Living the Liturgy, we use this as a textbook in the form of confirmation. I spend a brief one quarter on running through the small catechism. Then we spend time on the liturgical materials, living the liturgy, and what the symbolic books say about worship and sacraments. We go through the Augustana, the Augsburg Confession, and then the large catechism, and wind up then rediscussing all of this in light of the liturgy again by the film strips that are available. I use also the American Folk Song Mass. The youngsters appreciate this one. Misa Luba, you've probably heard of this one. They get a bang on that because of the drum music, Misa Luba. The 20th century folk music, folk mass by recording. I don't remember who made the recording. And then the latest one that I use is simply called Rejoice. It's put out by the Episcopal Church, and it emphasizes the activity of the people of God in their worship activity. This is what we're doing with the school with the emphasis on self. Now, I would like to stop here. It seems to me this is a legitimate place to stop. If you may have some questions directly that you would like to ask, then this is a legitimate place to stop.
Whatever you want to do.
Okay. I started typing out more of this, and I thought you're probably fed up with formal presentations, and you would rather just ask questions directly, and I would try to deal with them in the various forms in which I am involved. I'm involved in the mental health program of our county, in the city missions of our area, in the Minister Alliance forms, and which we have, and I could talk in these days. Yes, sir.
You were mentioning how you bring Christian education and experience in worship to the children. My question would be, what do you do in educating adults, especially the different worship forms, and from what they are familiar with?
Right. I use the midweek services. We have midweek Advent and Lenten services. I use these forms of services also as times and places in which we can introduce new hymns, new forms of worship, because this is a time when, at least the people in my area, are accustomed to assemble on Wednesday evening. And this is a good opportunity because about 80% of the congregation is present at these services. But it's more of an informal service, and for that reason, we can use introduction of different forms. We have a small choir, which we use to introduce new hymns, new forms of the liturgy, for instance. The parish where I am has a tremendous appreciation for the Lutheran hymns. And, well, as you probably know, they sing tremendously. And even though the hymns are new, they will give it all they have and work through these new forms. Surprisingly enough, the rural people, as I know them, do not rebel to something new simply because it's new. They rebel only if they don't understand. And if a proper explanation is given and proper terminology is given in light of the historic confessions, I have found no difficulty with this. If one just wants to place this in the form of service without any explanation, anything of this nature, I think they would be rebellious. But when I came to Huffman, one of the first things I did was go through the explanation of the liturgy. I began this with the voters' assembly and took every organization in the congregation, took it with these midweek services. Then I went through the Augsburg Confession and stated why we, as Lutherans, practice the Eucharist, celebrate the Eucharist every Sunday. And on the basis of this background, the people were very happy to accept this kind of situation. Because I came into a parish, which we call a Blacktown Bowtie Parish. Came into a parish, my predecessor, a fine evangelical man, but he was not particularly interested in liturgy, but he was interested in red bow ties and a black gown, Geneva gown. And this is a parish which practice page 5, except every other month. Every other month. Page 15, on the third Sunday, every other month. So 12, no, 6 times a year, plus New Year's Eve, Totem Fest. Very fitting time. There was this celebration. So this is some of the background. If I had come into that background with the vestments, as I presently wear, and with the practice of the Eucharist as we have it, I doubt whether I would have lasted 18 months. In fact, my counselor, when I left Minnesota, said, I'll give you 2 years, and if you last 2 years down there, I'll be surprised. But there's always a vacancy here in northern Minnesota, which is consoling for some reason. But with the proper explanation, and working through the school and through all these organizations, I found that when explanations are given, legitimate explanations from the confessions and from historic practice of the church, then there really isn't a difficulty. I everything gung-ho, without some background. They respect the person, and I should say this also, in the rural parish, there is a tremendous respect for the office of the ministry, not necessarily for the person, and repeatedly. Someone has told me that, I respect you as my parish pastor. I don't like you, though. Well, this is all right. I mean, it's the office that I'm concerned about. Yes.
Yes, sir. I wonder if you could say just a little bit more about your using pastoral counseling sessions for confession. I see the dynamics of both of those being somewhat different in certain respects. Like, do you pronounce the absolution all the time after a counseling session? Sometimes a counseling session would not resemble confession,
right,
it would seem to me. And I just wonder if you could expatiate just a little bit about this practice.
Yes, there is a difference. And this you can only play by ear, if I can use that expression. You only know by understanding the background of some of these people, which of these people expect, because they've come for that purpose, expect the formal proclamation of the absolution, and which of these people expect a rather informal proclamation of the absolution. I'm not so sure that your basic premise is correct, or that there are two different forms here, that private confession and counseling are two different areas. I'm not so sure that's right. I think that the basic concern, the emotional concern of an individual, makes private confession that much more important to him. I work with Irvington Mental Clinic, with a psychologist and a psychiatrist, and one of the things that these men had said repeatedly, we find that the fewest amount of people who come through our clinic are Roman Catholics or practicing Lutherans. He makes an emphasis of practicing Lutherans. Because here are people who have learned to appreciate what we know as private confession, and have understood in a person of their parish priest someone to whom they can go and trust with some legitimate advice. I would be very reluctant to make two separate fields here. I can only say that I think by dealing with the people, you know which person expects you to say, I, your pastor, absolve you from your sins. Or which one expects you to rather informally say the same thing. Now, this is what you mean by a dual practice.
Yes, well, I
maybe
see...
I
just see under some circumstances a pastoral counseling session or a series of sessions wouldn't necessarily entail a parishioner saying mea culpa to anything.
Yeah, right. In marriage counseling, for instance. This nature. I do this as a separate thing. I insist on going through the four sessions on counseling for people who are going to be married. But this is not private confession in that form. But this is also pastoral counseling. In that sense, you're right. This could be a broader term. I don't know if this helps in your explanation. Was I clarified anything?
Yes.
You have to. So that you simply play by ear. I know, for instance, Grandma Himmelhoek. I use Himmelhoek. Yeah, I don't know. Where I picked that term up, I think that will be credited. Yeah, yeah. The Zauer Braten was another one.
But Twain, Hopwood, and Schnitzmeyer.
Yeah, well, very similar. Well, I know Grandma Schnitzmeyer. That's not Grandma Schnitzmeyer. I know that she expects me to say, your sins are forgiven on the basis. But I also know that her granddaughter doesn't expect this kind of formal approach, although the form of the confession of both is very legitimate. Yes, sir?
I'm wondering if you can somehow, you can indicate to us regarding how you, what methodology and so forth you use for teaching the Old Testament. Do you have some resource material, or do you just use the text itself, or...
I use a printed text from CPH, and the paper, you know, that's paper thing for 25 cents, which you can distribute to everybody. And, of course, on Reformation Day, we do this, or on June, the proper day in June. We also take articles from the Augustana. I simply take the material as it is, with the introduction concerning the reason for the confession. And I do this for this reason, that the people where I am are well-versed in the confessions. And the Augsburg Confession has been publicly taught in the school as long as I know. And I'm not the one that introduces this. But I'm...
This is a revelation to me.
I'm reintroducing it in the sense of introducing it into Bible classes and such things like this. But the Augustana has been taught by the pastor of the parish with the small catechism. I know it ever since the turn of the century, I guess. I have only added the large catechism and the formal structure, or the study of the formal structure of liturgy. So I've had an advantage.
CPH has, he did this at Bethel, and then all the instructor has to do is take his Albeck or give him background and ask him how did this article comply to today, put it in session.
Right. Just a little, I thought I had one stuck in there. A little brown and white form. I have stuck in here another form of private confession, which I use with the 7th and 8th graders. A form is typed out, actually, from the LCA book. I don't know if I should say that, but it's in the LCA little red book. It's a good form. Very lucid. Someone else, yes?
Last year in Vicarage, I was in a smaller town community, at least different than my background. I'm from Milwaukee and accustomed to Manhattan, Kansas, which is something quite different from my background. But working with these people from a rural setting, I noticed a closeness that I had not found within an urban parish. Would you say that this is the same in your experience, and does that play a part in the way that you set up your parish program?
Yes, I think this is true. I can only speak from two rural parishes that are in. Right. I have an in. I'm in this one, not 10. But the kind of koinonia that you find there is probably more unique. In a sense that very often there's such interrelationships among the members of the parish. Our district president last Sunday was at our place, and I introduced him as our bishop, and he had the, he was a proclaimer, and this is one of the comments he made too. He said he's impressed by the tremendous koinonia. People obviously have come to worship, and not necessarily to come to criticize, but come to worship who appreciate what it means to be a man of God. And whether this is true in all rural parishes, I couldn't say. I wouldn't want to make general statements. This may be true, however. If it was in the case where you were, it may well be true in other parishes too. Yeah.
I have a question. Some of the others might be thinking of this too. Wouldn't the very conservative nature of the rural parish also cause problems, though? I mean conservative in a bad sense now.
Yeah.
How do you, or do you, bring to them some of the crucial issues of our time? Is the racial crisis real to them? Vietnam and all the other problems, would they tend simply to dismiss the student uprising today as being radicals who don't respect authority? How do your people relate the issues of the world to the gospel?
They relate it in the sense that I make the opportunity on Sunday morning to make these issues relevant, at least I think relevant, in the proclamation of the day. In that sense, they become an issue for them. The issue of Vietnam, naturally, is an issue to all these people. We have 12 young men in Vietnam, or in the armed services, and some of them in Vietnam. So that this is not a question being relevant. These people understand this as a relevant issue because of relatives involved in that particular strife. Other issues aren't quite so relevant. The strife in Berkeley, for instance, doesn't strike them as too important. I make a point of this on Sunday morning, and we discuss this in light of the gospel, then it makes sense. And then we can discuss it. And I spend, in fact, I must say, say that I spend much of the Bible class material discussing, rediscussing the gospel of the day, which fits into their thinking. Now, the racial problem is an issue in the sense that we are 5 miles from Centralia. A large part of Centralia is Negro. Although we do not have an integrated parish in Centralia, we do have people who attend our services occasionally who are members of the Negro community. And I have been involved with the Negro community personally, which makes the congregation involved also, and they're aware of it, by the fact that I'm chairman of the Ministerial Alliance, and I've spoken several times at Second Baptist Church and these other community endeavors which are integrated. And so we have an opportunity of discussing this question on Sunday morning and its relevancy to the congregation as a congregation, as the people of God. beyond that, I don't know how relevant it would be until it becomes an issue next door for us.
You said at the beginning that as far as the location is concerned, being in rural, you didn't think that your ministry was that unique. And yet you also stated that you noticed a greater sense of koinonia and stuff like that.
Well, he mentioned that, and I commented on it. This may be true, yes.
Well, what about the simple fact that the differences in occupations? It seems to me that I remember talking to one of my uncles who was a minister up in a rural situation, and he said sometimes you almost had to know all sorts of stuff, not in depth, but you have to know something about farmers' problems and stuff like that.
Well, I think that's necessary, actually, if I can, however, do this. We have 705 members. We are a rural parish, but of these 705 members, only 66 are farmers. The rest are bankers, they are school teachers, they are other professional people. So that, in a sense, I have to know something about the problem of a farmer. And I'm concerned about this. When this NFO issue was an issue, and it was in our area, this is where some of these people meet up, but you probably know one of these is one of my members. I was involved in this issue, I attended their meetings, I didn't agree with some of the procedure, but I could feel for these people and their problem of being priced out of the market. And so I was involved in that kind of thing to understand the problems of these people. But I think you have to say then we have to be concerned about the problems of other people in the same parish, not just the 66 or maybe related 80, but the other 600 people. So this is a rural parish, but it doesn't mean that all of these people are farmers. Let's say, as you can notice, the 20% less are really farmers in that sense. Once there was almost all farmers in that sense, but now we have 500,000 to 800,000 acres, one man or his family.
Yes. Well, these questions, can I interrupt and invite anyone who wants to take some calls?
Yeah, keep you awake here.
Oh, you know, and while you ask your questions, I'll draw you.
May I make an announcement also? Yeah. Wayne Chagle wrote some. Somehow, you know, I feel a compulsion to get involved with them, if only maybe a letter to a like to ask you the question. We obviously have, you know, very wholesome worship life and educational life there in the church. How do you see getting your people involved? How is that possible? And I see this is one really crucial issue. And then I was trying to follow that up. If maybe these big issues aren't the issue that you're studying, Vietnam, et cetera, or the race question, or the kind of the third world. What are? I mean, I tend to, because of my background, I've always heard from sociologists that, yes, you do have koinonia, but that koinonia can be stultifying.
Yeah.
Because everyone does know, you know, what's going on. And how do you handle those kinds of situations?
You handle it, it seems to me, handling like handling any other problem with the law, where obviously this is a false koinonia, if you refer to it.
I was meaning more methods. You make a lot of calls during the...
Yes.
Is that one of the primary emphases of your ministry?
Well, the first 3 years of the ministry there, I spent almost every afternoon visiting in order that I might understand this parish. I don't do that now because I understand the parish, I think. At least it's rather ridiculous for me to go to a place this man has lived there all his life. The same group is still there that has been there 10 years ago. I know the whole situation. Family has not changed. And occasionally will call on these people if there's what I would consider some different kind of problem. But to just be a social gadabout is not my interpretation of the ministry. To understand this parish, though, when I came, was necessary. For that reason, I had to spend a great deal of time simply visiting each place to find out what it is. I'd like to get back to this other thing, the relevancy of the ministry. Now, perhaps an example of this maybe. I have sympathy with the people who are striking in California, these great strikers, for instance. I have sympathy in understanding, trying to understand their situation, their problem. I personally can't do much about it except, as you indicate, right to a congressman or something like that. It doesn't really make any important sense to me to make this an issue where I am, to say to these people there is a problem there in California concerning these strikers, so forth, when I know I have another more critical issue, and that presently is the NFO and the problem of our farmers who basically have the same problem. And so this is where the relevancy, this is where the rubber hits the road there for them. It doesn't hit it in California, but it hits there concerning this NFO program, the Farm Bureau interpretation of this, very conservative interpretation of this, and the NFO's rather radical interpretation of this. For a certain group of people, this is an important issue, and we discuss it on that basis. I don't know.
I was going to follow that up and say, if you don't concern some of the great thinkers, there must be other issues closer to home.
Yeah, well, the NFO is one of the issues.
And community.
Yeah. Well, there are a number of issues. That is one issue, but another whole issue is this, right now, is a mental health referendum. Did I know if I mentioned it? We're working on a mental health referendum for a country. This is an issue, very not only a very practical issue, but I think it's an important issue for our people. And to get this kind of understanding that's necessary for an evaluation of this program takes education. It takes a lot of slow day-by-day activity. This is a relevant issue for us. This is going to come up for vote sometime in September this next year. But it's going to take, all of us in the county, it's going to take a great deal of educational background.
Do you set up study groups then at your parish?
Yes, we do.
We
have a study group, and we discuss these issues also in all these organizations. We have in our men's group, our caucus club, ladies' group, or two different ladies' groups, and our young people. We don't call them Walter Leaguers now, that's a term that's no longer used. Our young people. We discuss these issues in that area. Each one of these organizations has a representative on the larger group, which then speaks this to the larger community, carries it to our, in this case, the comprehensive mental health board of the district, and then of the county.
You said that Centralia is only 5 miles.
Yeah, it's about 5 miles, 161.
I would imagine that
because they live in Centralia doesn't mean they necessarily have that much different of an occupation. They may still be working in the bank, although they're working Centralia Bank instead of the Huffman Bank. They're working for the railroad out of Centralia rather than out of Huffman, but the problem is basically the same. We no longer have the miners. We did have the miners until a couple years ago, but after the tragedy of 109 killed, 110 claims, we don't have the miners except the retired members of the of that group. So that their occupations are not that different. The village, the limits, city limits of Centralia and the village limits of Huffman almost touch, although there is this 6 mile on the highway, 6 mile strip. But the ministries are interrelated. And I really don't know that there's that much difference in the practice and problems of the parish in Centralia than there is with us. I know Pastor Timmy there. In fact, I took care of the congregation for a year in Centralia. And their problems were really basically the same as ours. In fact, they're just as many farmers as we do, although they're from Centralia.
You had mentioned before, you know, it was a black question.
Yeah. Well, this is an issue in Centralia, that's right. An issue for the Centralia congregation is the fact that our parish there, Trinity Parish, is right on the borderline of the Negro community. This is Highway 161 and Pleasant Avenue runs here, and our Trinity Church is there, the one in town. And the black community is basically right here. There has been no contact between here and there. That has been my concern. When I was a vacancy man there, there's one member who is Negro, and she came to Trinity only by transfer. She was a member of East St. Louis, and then transferred to Trinity in Centralia. And they refused to transfer originally. But we finally got that worked out. But there's no, there's a large Second Baptist church here, and that serves as the church for the. There's an American Baptist church here, which is all Caucasian. They have no interrelationship either, those two groups. That's a problem of the community there, which we're working on. We do have a committee, interracial committee on this problem. Yeah. That doesn't affect me personally, right, in Huffman, because we don't have this. Yes, sir?
Do the young people of your parish see their future in terms of Huffman, Illinois, or do they want to get to the big city?
Well, yeah, they want to get to the big city where the action is, suburbia. What is happening in the 10 years that I'm there, the congregation has increased about 120. Most of these are young people. Of this parish, 42% of the parish members are not 21, not of voting age. 42%. This is a young parish. So that it indicates these young people are staying. They're living in Huffman, working in Centralia, or one couple working in Carlisle, neighboring community, or in other cases, live in Centralia and yet farm part of their father's farm. Live in Huffman farm, part of their father's farm. So the young people really are not moving out. They're building new homes right in our area. We have a dozen new houses built within these last 3 years right in town. So that, of course, over a period of not too long, we probably will be part of Centralia. And then they'll be part of, well, what's Centralia? 18,000. That's really not too big. That's a big town for a farm boy.
You're speaking actually of Huffman and of your own experience.
Yes,
there.
Right. Sure. I know.
Have you done any reading or thinking about the rural ministry's future? To hear about urbanization of America, the flight to the cities, and the reaction back where people who live in the cities need a second house back in the country again.
Yeah.
But really, the flight to the cities, young people going there. As far as the rural church as a whole is concerned, a lot of people say it's in decline. It's not the wave of the future, not for America. Do you have any thoughts about this?
Yeah, I think this is true, that in some parts of the country that rural churches are on the decline, but It is also true that in other parts, in our case, or is a case in point, there is an increase of this, where the people are living in a small town, working someplace else. Now, we have people working in St. Louis who are living in Huffman. They work at Scott Air Force Base, live in Huffman. And they live in a small town like ours because of economics. First of all, it's cheaper to live there. The closeness of the society, in that sense, more of an open society. And I don't see that there would be a complete decline of the rural ministry. Surely our church is not rural as it once was. 60%, we figured rural not too many years ago. What is it figured today? 35? Maybe it's the lowest time. But that's because of a large amalgamation of congregations. We still have these small groups. Now we have, only a few miles from me, we have three little congregations right under the road. There's Oakerville and there's two neighboring little they each have a little parish. This is not going to continue. We give them another 5-6 years at the most. And this will be one parish, as I think it ought to be. Particularly with the manpower situation. Is this the end of it?
No, we can go for you.
Okay.
You had said that your membership is about 7-5, and it says increased 100 some in your pastor.
Yeah, a little over 500.
Has this been mostly people that have come into the congregation, or what is your function, you know, going out and seeking out new members in mission work?
Well, first of all, we'll put it this way. The part of the county in which I am, eastern part of the county, is basically evangelical Catholic. The western part is Roman Catholic. Our town, with the exception of two families, is evangelical Catholic. And they are wandering Methodists. I say wandering Methodist because they were members of the First Methodist, now Faith Methodist, and then they're members of the Trinity Methodist in town. They haven't quite made up their mind where they went wrong. And that's their business, not really. But the other only 10 miles from me is a town called Germantown, same size as Huffman, Germantown. That is Roman Catholic, in the same setup. One church, and with the exception of two families, all Roman Catholic. We're in a situation where except these two families are all members of the same parish. So we get people by absorption probably more than anything else. They come in and unless they got a lot of willpower, like these wandering Methodists, they and they intermarry with our people, and that's how we get it. I'm no great missionary in that sense, but I line these guys up. But I must say that I got that my contact through the Alliance Club, I have accounted for four families. My contact through the mental health program involved me with at least a dozen other families. So, next again, this guy.
I don't know whether it's possible to answer this question or not, but when you came into the rural ministry, what adapting did you and your family have to do personally?
Well,
what special stresses
are placed on him? Yeah, there's a dash. My wife was from St. Paul, Minnesota. I grew up in Lakeview, Minnesota, which is a small town. It's 3,800 or 4,000, something like that, which wasn't that large. The first thing that I had to understand was the cultural menu, the whatever term I use, of Southern Illinois rural people. This sometimes can be shocking, at least it was for me. I was surprised at the what I considered the basic ignorance of these farmers. But it wasn't so much basic ignorance, it's the fact, rather, that they're not about to buy something they don't understand. And it, for me, it meant an educational process of getting to know these people personally. And in this understanding, then work out an educational program. This took time. As I mentioned in Knoxville's non-profit mission before, it took me 3 years to understand this parish, to know what I was doing, to know how the about 3 years before we're able to launch into this program of understanding what the Worship Black community is. When you come into a Blacktown parish, Bowtie Blacktown parish, you have to understand the situation first. You have to know where people are before you can start. If they're here and you're someplace they're here, you have to somewhere get where they are to start. And that, to me, was the educational process, to understand the background of Israel. I'm in present. I brought these along really to show Dr. Wolf, but he's displayed them here. I brought them along just to show you what happens in the thinking of a building committee 10 years later. We are in a building right now that's an old structure built by a Norwegian carpenter. A Norwegian, you know, it's Norwegian, isn't it? Norwegians have a pulpit on top of the altar. They're sure that the word is above. Yeah, you know this. So that's the kind of structure we got. It's a long structure. It's a long name. And the altar is, of course, obviously flat up against the wall here. And on top of the altar is the pulpit. There's no lectern, I think, pulpit up there. To make sure that the superiority of the word over the sacrament is going to be sacramental. Now, when in 1960 we originally had talked about building a church, because our building is pretty well padded, and the building committee was formed then, but that was before we finished the study that I was talking about. And so the building committee's original concepts were entirely different. They want to duplicate this kind of structure and all that stuff. Well, I didn't spend too much time arguing that point, except working with the congregation as such, understanding the worshiping community. This is the diagram, or this is the outline they come up with now 10 years later. We're building this now in January. Our own building comes down, and next week December will be in it. But that can only be done in understanding the community, trying to interpret this understanding, and then filling what is missing by the worship, with the understanding of the worship by the community.
Who could have... this could not have possibly done 10 years to sell them on a freestanding altar. My good night, where's the pulpit? I'd have to have the pulpit hanging from the... So to have the pulpit on the gospel side, impossible. And have a baptismal font on the epistle side. Well, I'd rather have it here, but that was a bit too much. Yeah, maybe 10 years later. Yeah.
I don't know whether this you encountered this. I suppose we all have visions of the Christian newsboys looking behind the bushes of the parish house and that. How do you handle the bastards in a parish, you know? These kind of people who are just at you.
With a good sense of humor. Good sense of humor. I don't, I never get overworked about these guys.
Do you have any?
Yes. I have, my postmaster is a regular subscriber and reader of the Yellow Journal. And every time I come to the post office, that's once a day, probably at 9:35, and he knows that. A few times I've changed the time just to upset him, which I really upset him. But promptly at 9:35, I go down and I hear the latest, and of course I can make my comments on this. My comments are very mundane and not very enlightening. I sometimes approach him and say, are you in the talking mood today, or is this the day, or are you going to tirade about something that you've read? Well, he understands it. And, he's a regular member. We have about four families who are involved as regular worshippers of the Golden Calf. I think a sense of humor is vital, not only in that setting, but... I never take myself too seriously either. And I think this is important. I think Luther once said this. Once after some debate, he said, after theology and music, you've got to have a sense of humor. I may not be able to get to the other two, but I think I got a sense of humor.
He said that when you first came, you know, it was a Blacktown parish, but now that you've reached the point where you're using Eucharistic vestments, how long did it take you to?
3 years. I spent the 3-year study, in which we worked at this thing gradually.
And then after the 3 years you had?
Yeah, right. This was Well, I don't know if you know anything about Southern Illinois, but Southern Illinois is predominantly Baptist, and hard-shell Baptist, not the regular American Baptist, which, with which you can compete, but the fundamentalistic, primitive, hard-shell Baptist. These are real characters. When I came into a tie, I don't own a tie. Never did. Yes, I did too. I got married. But I don't have a tie. I have a couple of turtleneck sweaters, which I wear when I teach at Catholic College, because that's the regulation. I have to do that. But I came into this situation with a clerical, not really realizing that this could be an offensive thing. I discover later that it is. But you deal with this on the basis of the understanding of the parish. And when this is later on explained, and evangelically, sometimes third degree with somebody, this is the law, no matter how you do it, you gotta do it. When this is explained evangelically, that the gospel isn't judged on the basis of a man's dress, this is understood.
What did you wear, what kind of vestments did you wear first?
The cassock.